Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. I know there are a number of things that may have kept you away, so great to see you all here. My name is Ben Bland. I'm the director of the Southeast Asia program at the Lowy Institute, and I also work on Hong Kong, which is what we're going to be talking about today. I want to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and paying my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Pleased today, really pleased to be joined by Ted Hui, a democracy activist and, I guess, against your choice, former legislative councillor from Hong Kong. After studying law, Ted actually didn't go into the law, unlike many politicians in Hong Kong and elsewhere. He went straight into politics, working as a researcher, then a local councillor, and ultimately a member of Hong Kong's partially democratic legislative council for the Democratic Party in Hong Kong. Ted is and was and has been a committed and vocal defender of human rights, not just in the legislature, but on the streets of Hong Kong. I think being pepper sprayed at least twice,
or more than that,
many times at close range by the Hong Kong police while trying to act as a kind of middleman to diffuse some of the tension we saw on the streets of Hong Kong in 2019 and 2020, unfortunately failing to diffuse those tensions. And Ted, I guess, sadly fled Hong Kong last year, facing multiple, some clearly politically motivated prosecutions. We can talk about that in a minute. To initially seek sanctuary in Europe and the UK, but then decided in March to move to Australia to extend, I guess, a kind of a new position trying to advocate for Hong Kong and Hong Kongers in Australia. Today we're going to be discussing Beijing's intensifying crackdown on Hong Kong, which intensifies depressingly by the day, and discussing where the city's democracy movement goes from here. But before we get into that, I want to ask a bit about your story, Ted. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to leave your home?
That's a really long story. Anyway, thanks for inviting me, and I'm honored to be here to talk to you. The reason that I had to leave Hong Kong is that Hong Kong has totally changed. Hong Kong is no longer Hong Kong, not like the Hong Kong we knew before, after the 2019 freedom movement and after the introduction of the national security law. Because in Hong Kong, we used to have freedom, even if it's not a democracy. I would say a high degree of freedom. And we could chant slogans, we could take it to the streets demonstrations, assemblies. But after 2019, after the national security law, they became impossible. And people like me, and on the opposition camp, or freedom side of Hong Kong, or for the Hong Kong's politics, and all the dissents are now not tolerated at all. So parliamentarians are thrown to jails because of the things they've said in chamber, in parliament, because people like me participated in street demonstrations, standing with young protesters, and they put charges against us, criminal charges, national security charges. So I knew that if I stayed in Hong Kong, I would face decades of jail time and perhaps life imprisonment. And to me and to many in Hong Kong, I dare say, jail time is not scary. It's not the most frightening. But what's scary is that losing our freedoms, and then no one can speak up for Hong Kong anymore in the future, so Hong Kong's voices cannot be heard. Because when even journalists are expelled, journalists, and local media are controlled, then we will become just like normal Chinese city, and to the extreme, like North Korea, without the world hearing us. So I feel that it's the need of leaving Hong Kong, even though it's a painful decision. I left with a very heavy heart, but I felt responsible, and I still feel responsible of doing so for Hong Kong.
And I mean, how many charges or cases were you facing at that time when you left?
At the time when I left, I was facing 9 criminal charges. For example, perverting the course of justice for my participation in the streets, They accused me for covering up the crimes that the protesters done by standing in front of them. And also, there are charges against me for contempt of legislature, which is very ridiculous as a legislator myself. And what I said about what the things that I said and the act of protest, they were just like holding up signs at my seat and in the chamber, and not obeying the president, the probation legislator's order, and resisting security guards of the legislature. It's very ridiculous ones. 9 charges, so I was on bail. So, and I left Hong Kong because I received invitations by Danish parliamentarians who invited me for international meetings.
So, and at that point, your passport, you actually had to surrender it to the court or to the police, is that right? So you almost needed to organise the event in Denmark as a way to leave. Without that, you would basically be sitting in prison now in Hong Kong.
Basically, everyone facing criminal charges would have their passport confiscated. And so, yes, my passport once was confiscated by the court, but then I did have a track record of flying around the globe and talk about climate change. And so at that time, my Danish parliamentarian friends invited me to their country to join international meeting. And that's why at that time, the court and the police were convinced that, oh, it's only your regular routines. So they let me go. And that's why they granted me back my passport. So maybe I was just lucky.
Yeah, and I think after that, the Hong Kong authorities said both that they want to pursue you here and wherever, and also even talked about trying to prosecute those Danish parliamentarians for kind of colluding to damage national security or something along those lines.
Yes, and my Danish friends who invited me actually told me it happened, that the Chinese regime, the Hong Kong regime, actually made a formal request to the Danish enforcement to the police, requesting that their parliamentarians who invited me should be prosecuted and should be extradited. And it is so disrespectful, and no one can imagine that it's happening. It's a wolf warriors kind of diplomacy.
And it's not just yourself, but you know, I was a journalist in Hong Kong and an author from 2015 to 2019. I interviewed pretty much every pro-democracy member of the Legislative Council and many other activists fighting for democracy or their rights in Hong Kong, and pretty much all those people with any prominence who I knew then are now either in jail or in exile, with almost no exceptions. Mm-hmm. Which is just, yeah, it's remarkable how quickly and how kind of deep the cuts to Hong Kong's autonomy and rights have been. But for you, at a personal level, like, how hard was it to leave your home? I mean, I guess you're not just leaving kind of the fight behind for democracy explicitly, but like your family, your friends, your way of life. I mean, how difficult is that?
It's very, very difficult. And I grew up in Hong Kong all my life, even though I spent 3 years of study in Canada. And that's the only time I left Hong Kong. And then I returned. And I've been fighting so very hard with my comrades, with my party colleagues, with all the activists in Hong Kong. I can't remember how many times we marched together in the streets of Hong Kong for democracy and freedom. And we did it like 5-6 times a year. So, and I can't also recall how many times we fought in the chamber of the parliament with speeches and with all the physical struggles, and with all the young people in Hong Kong in 2019. So they really are my comrades. And it's very depressing to see them being thrown to jail, detained, and their assets frozen. It's on a literally everyday basis. So I read the news every day, it's painful. And it's not like very distant. It's not like they, for many Hong Kongers, they are the representatives of the people, but they are my friends. I know their families, I know their kids. Yeah, their kids play with my kids, so it's very painful. But then also, it's not easy for my family, and especially my parents. They followed me here, And at their age, it's harder to adapt to a new life and with language barrier and new environment, climate. So it's a totally new place. And what's painful or what's heavy the most is that as I talk to quite many Hong Kongers here, they would talk about going back to Hong Kong and to see the families, to taste the food, and to refresh their memories of Hong Kong, even they live here. But that's the thing I can't do, and I don't know for how long I'll be staying here. But then my memories of Hong Kong, my loved ones, my favorite places, and would just fade away as time goes by. It's very sad to think about that.
It is. It's sad, and there's no escaping that. Mm-hmm. And what prompted the move to Australia specifically? Because I know that at first you were in Denmark, and then you went to the UK, I believe. So what made you come here, which wasn't an easy thing, given the rigorous border controls in place with COVID and everything else?
Yeah, it's a difficult choice, actually. So I struggled and talked to quite many people, and I also considered the international situations. Yes, I spent 3 months in London, the UK, and then I took the time and opportunity to meet quite many parliamentarians there and activists, and also my comrades there, people like Nathan Law and quite other Hong Kongers in exile. So we had a lot of discussions, and I understood their future plans, what their future plans are. And then I made up my mind, because I understand that since they are more UK-based and Europe-based, and there are quite a few number of them. And I also was in contact with the other comrades and other politicians in exile in North America. And they are doing also so well, organized and already on track. And so my idea was to spread Hong Kong's message in different parts of the globe. And so I was looking at Australia and New Zealand, and they are among the Five Eyes and important strategically, and with large number of Hong Kongers, large diaspora community. So I believe that I was responsible to fill the gap, to be there and to get the people, Hong Kongers, here organized. And also I believe it's important that strategically to lobby parliamentarians and government officials here, because Australia is an important trade partner with China. So there's room for me to talk more on China policy.
And yeah, what do you think you can realistically achieve here? I know you've only been in Australia a few months thus far, but yeah, what do you think you can achieve? And also, what do you think Australia can and should do about what's happening in Hong Kong? It's obviously very difficult for any outside power to influence Xi Jinping's regime. Mm-hmm. So yeah, what do you want to achieve, and what do you think Australia can do?
I wouldn't say I want to put Australia to test, but the fact that I'm allowed here, it has an implication on the Australian government, on whether Australia will continue to be on the freedom side. And so I'm grateful, of course. During even COVID time, I was given a visitor visa so that I can enter. And on top of that, I was given exemptions to come in COVID time. And so and Australian government even facilitated my flight. So it's not an easy task. But of course, I would wish that the Australian government take stronger and stronger concrete actions, because I can see that the Morrison government is supportive and is vocal on Hong Kong's issues, and I'm grateful for that. But then if you compare the measures being taken by other countries from among the Five Eyes, if you look at US, who took the initiatives in all the sanctions individually and with all the executive orders of banning Chinese companies from operating in the countries. And if you look at the UK of giving most generous BNO visas and safe havens for many Hong Kongers to go to flee from the terror of CCP. And if you compare them, Australians has only given student visa, extending student visas. It's not benefiting a lot of Hong Kongers. And so I wish that Australia can have more concrete actions. Of course, in Australia, Australian government doesn't have the tool of sanctioning because they doesn't have the law. And I wish that the Magnitsky Act can be prioritized so that it has the tool to punish the wrongdoers, human rights abusers, to be in line with other countries to take really concrete actions.
We know that Australia's relationship with China is already in a very bad place, despite it being at least previously an important trade partner. Obviously, many trade sanctions now that Australia is facing. And I guess some people would say, look, the relationship's bad enough. Why do we need to do anything to help Hong Kong? Or I guess they would say the same about, you know, the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. It's not our problem. We're just going to make our own situation worse. There's no benefit there for the Australian people. So why should people care about Hong Kong, and why should Australia pay a price, potentially in terms of its relationship with China to fight for rights for people in a city that's ultimately quite far away, where what Australia does at the end of the day probably won't be very impactful?
Yeah, that's a question that definitely needs a clear answer. And I get the questions quite often, honestly, here. And I would just put very, very simple questions to not just parliamentarians and officials, but ordinary Australian citizens. Would they want Australia to be on the freedom camp, on the freedom side, on the right side of history, or be an ally or a business trading partner with CCP, with authoritarian governments who have brutal crackdown on Hong Kong? So which side do Australian people want to be on? And I think it's simple. And Australian values is about freedom. It's about democracies. And I just don't think that these important universal values can be in any way compromised, not in Australia, not in other parts of the world. So it's important to make it clear. The message is that for people like me, I'm not advocating a total boycott or disconnections, close down all the businesses with China. But think about the degree or the line when, for example, if universities in Australia dare not speak up for academic freedom because they care too much about the intake of their mainland Chinese students as their main source of incomes. That's why they'll be willing to be silent in face of persecutions by the CCP on Hong Kong and to the Chinese. Would that be Australian value, right? If businesses, construction companies, they are willing to be silent because they have the constructions, opportunities, and infrastructures in Belt and Road initiatives, and would that be Australian values? I just don't think that is. So I don't think Australians will be proud of their countries, their country, if their country is submissive or can be self-censoring themselves, and to be willing to be kind of controlled economically by the superpower. I don't think Australians will be proud of their countries. So I wish that I understand that economic interests and economy is important for people's everyday life, but there are other ways to work around, to be less reliant on Beijing's economic markets. And I believe that the Australian government can be wise enough to do that.
I want to go back a bit, to Hong Kong and to what happened with the unprecedented protests of 2019 into 2020, which I guess sparked the huge crackdown in a sense. There's obviously been a vicious circle in the last decade, if you like, of kind of people feeling under pressure from Beijing, protest movements, and then more kind of repression coming after, which triggers more protests. But what was it? I mean, you were out on the streets talking to a lot of young people and protesting as well in your own way. What motivated people to be out on the streets kind of risking so much, which, you know, and now they've lost a lot since then. They've paid a really high price. But what was really driving that, do you think?
I believe that the young people, they felt very desperate. They felt that it's their last chance of fighting. If they lose, then it could be that they lose forever. They could never win again. So I don't agree. Of course, social movements can be in the long run, and I mean a long battle. But young people were really desperate about speaking up. And at the time they grew up, and it was the time that Hong Kong is under tightened control, and that they felt that even the system, the legislature and the courts is controlled all by CCP, and there's no justice in the society. And on the other hand, they got nothing to lose. And since they were given the opportunity anyway to be in charge, to run the society, if even they go to vote, those representatives, people like me, can't do anything in the parliament anyway for the past 24 years. It seemed to them that we couldn't achieve what they really wanted, a true, genuine democracy, one man, one vote system. So why not? And also, they've looked back to the history. That Hong Kongers have tried different means from the very early time of the handover. We joined politics. We trusted in the system, in the electoral systems, and we changed policies inside parliament. We tried that, but to no avail. We tried peaceful demonstrations, a lot of times million people joined, and to no avail. And we tried civil disobedience with the umbrella movement, but didn't win. So why not try harder, more physical confrontations? And they believe that's the way to go. And I agreed. And we have to confront the regimes. I believe that democracy just doesn't go to us by mercy of CCP, so we have to fight.
And as you said, it's really hard to predict kind of the crests and the troughs of social movements, but I mean, do you think it's right, those young people's worst fear, in a sense that we're probably unlikely to see another big mass social movement in Hong Kong again for the foreseeable future, given that the costs of protesting, both, you know, in terms of potential jail time, being beaten up by the police, other things are so high, and all the avenues for resistance in legislative council and elsewhere have been cut off. So do you think it's true, in a sense, that we probably won't ever see another massive social movement like that again for the foreseeable future?
Foreseeable future, of course, yes. Maybe we might not see something similar with the 2019 protest, but then the spirit's still here. And the spirit of the movement, the freedom movement, 2019, and we also have a slogan called "Be Water." So people are water. People can be powerful. Water can be powerful, but we are also flexible. So sometimes we divide. Sometimes we rejoin. And I think it's time for us to be water, to stay calm, reserve our power and energy. And I believe that given time, some point in the future, triggered by some political incidents, international situations, people definitely will rise again, as long as our spirit's still high and our hearts are still angry. We have not given up. We just need some international hands, and we just need to transform our struggles into other forms. Like last 2 weeks, in Hong Kongers were not allowed to have public assemblies in commemorations with the June 4 Tiananmen massacre. But then I believe that hundreds of thousands of people held their candles in their hands and roam around in the city in memory of the events. And that can be totally banned by the regimes. So these powers are transformed into other forms, and that would be the new phase of Hong Kong's protests.
And in terms of what's happening in Hong Kong, as we said at the start, the pace of the crackdown is really relentless. So just yesterday we had hundreds of police raiding the offices of Apple Daily, leading pro-democracy, but also just entertainment newspaper in Hong Kong, arresting journalists and executives. And this was the first time that the new national security law had been used explicitly to target journalists for their journalistic work, not other aspects. We also saw the government come out and basically describe these people as criminals, although they've only been arrested. So technically, you normally call them suspects. But anyway, every day, basically, there's something happening like that. There's someone new being arrested or a new case. What do you think, I mean, trying to put yourself in Xi Jinping's shoes, if you can, I mean, what's his end game? I mean, he's ultimately, and the Communist Party's calling the shots, not the Hong Kong government. What do they want to see in Hong Kong? Do they want it to be just like Shenzhen, another mainland city, maybe more like Macau, where things look a bit different on the surface, but there's total control? Or is it even worse than being in the mainland because it's kind of an area for the CCP of weakness and resistance? Do they have to actually have a much more tougher, securitized kind of policy that looks almost something more like what we've seen in the past in Tibet or Xinjiang?
If I were Xi Jinping, I would think that now my emperor is strong enough economically. We're already a superpower, and most countries in the world needs to kowtow to me. So anyway, not like in the past, that I want to keep Hong Kong to maintain its freedoms, and so the West would admire it, look onto it. And Xi Jinping would think that, oh, we still got investment in Hong Kong. We still can earn money. We can be like Singapore and take total control. And why would I tolerate those unpleasant dissents? And that could be a danger to my power in the future. So I believe that China has grown too arrogant on that and too confident. And it would be easy for a superpower to crack down and to make everyone leave. And I don't think Xi Jinping cares anymore when most Hong Kongers from the older generation or my generation all leave Hong Kong and we be replaced by their own people, the mainlanders. And now I believe it's in the middle of doing it. And that's the rationale. I think that's what Xi Jinping is thinking about.
But I mean, if we're honest, it's not just about kind of replacing Hong Kongers, because part of the problem is that Hong Kong, I guess, has always been divided, right? We saw in all the different elections and polls, maybe there's 55 or 60% of Hong Kongers who, in some senses, are broadly pro-democracy. And then you see, you know, a significant chunk, almost half of the city, is either kind of explicitly in favor of the Communist Party or just wants to live and work, you know, with part of the PRC in a more harmonious way. And I guess we saw that on the streets of Hong Kong and yesterday too, right? Most of those 500 police outside the Apple Daily offices and inside were Hong Kongers. What's kind of going through their mind in this divided city? I mean, why do you think it is that some people, you know, similar background to you, similar experiences, would take almost like the opposite view from you about the future of their city too?
It's a good question, because so I sometimes have doubts, but why some Hong Kongers would turn their back on democracy and freedoms and just to accept that all dissents can be eliminated and continue to work for and to support the regimes. I would say they're not the majority. The majority is very clearly shown in opinion polls. And of course, in the last genuine elections in 2019, at the district council local elections, in which the Democrats had a landslide win. And also, I believe that's what touched the Beijing's nerve, that it should be cracking down Hong Kong's totally. But then I would say for many, they just need to survive. They don't particularly support dictatorship, and quite many of them even can be sympathetic to people like me, like us. But then they need to survive. They they need their life to go on. And when all the opportunities are controlled and provided by the CCP, and what can they do? And I receive that quite a lot. I'm quite impartial in the, just in the middle, but I just need to continue my life. Those are the people. But then the other part of the reason is that quite many people can be brainwashed. And you can see after the new national security law, and the regime is changing, making changes in education, changing textbooks, changing history books, and to make people really believe that being oppositions or to be dissent is unpatriotic, and which is not right, which is immoral. Maybe the newer generations will really believe in that, so there are two limbs.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that will succeed? Because I guess in the past there were similar efforts. I mean, going back in the history of the protest movements, I think one of the foundational ones of the modern era was the 2012 scholarism protests, which were against this push to bring in sort of mainland or communist-style patriotic education. So there was actually a big reaction against that. I mean, do you think people will still react against these things, or do you think, you know, younger generations who don't know will grow up and think differently about their relationship with the People's Republic of China and the Communist Party?
Well, I don't believe that the regime will succeed in really changing people's heart, but it might succeed in changing people's behavior, so that there are certain topics that's defined as red lines and we shouldn't cross, and then teacher...
I think we've crossed most of them already today.
Yes, of course. So teachers wouldn't be speaking about it in school, and of course they become taboo, and students wouldn't talk about it. But at home, their parents would talk about it, and they know exactly what the truth is. So they can't brainwash everyone. Of course, it can't.
And talking about kind of the next generation, I mean, one thing that I find kind of quite concerning is just the number of people who've been arrested and facing prosecution in Hong Kong. So I think more than 10,000 arrested during and since the 2019 protests. I think more than 2,500 have been prosecuted so far. And Hong Kong only has a prison population of 7,000 people. So even if it's just hundreds of people, and I think probably hundreds probably have already been jailed already, but you're potentially looking at thousands of people adding to 7,000 people in prison. What happens to this new generation of people who are effectively political prisoners? Kind of, do they come out and become kind of new martyrs for the cause? I mean, just, I guess some of those people are struggling as we speak in prison, and maybe they just give up hope altogether and back away. But what happens, like, to the fabric of a society when you have so many people criminalized for expressing thoughts that at least half of the city shares?
I believe the regime doesn't care, and I've heard personally that they even have plans to build more prisons for political prisoners. And with the introduction of the law of banning people from leaving Hong Kong, this law has already been introduced, effective in the coming 1st of August. The Hong Kong itself is a big prison. People can't leave. The regime has complete control on who can leave, and it can ban anyone from boarding any planes or boats. So it's already a big prison. So in terms of what the young people would become after jail times, it's very sad. It's not, I would say it's worse than having a typical criminal record in other crimes, because you're labeled as unpatriotic, and that label follows you for life in Hong Kong, and you can't leave, you can't go to other countries. And so think about when they need to find jobs, and with organizations, they will be on the blacklisted. It's very miserable, so that goes nowhere. And of course, for those young people, they wouldn't give up. They would continue their fight. So it's like, it's more like a circle. They goes back to the streets, and they get arrested again, and they got more radical. And so I don't think that it would be good governance at all. It can't achieve what it wanted.
And I guess it's going to be hard practically just to govern Hong Kong if people are so unhappy. And I mean, even in mainland China, there's a kind of element of consent, right? That there's no, obviously, free and fair elections, but people to some extent have an understanding that the party is acting in their best interests, at least on some key issues, but especially on the economy. But in Hong Kong, you don't even have that. Like how do you even manage the city without any consent? I guess it's going to be very difficult.
Yes, it can. And of course, it's not a good thing to do. But if you look at Singapore, right, and I don't think there's democracy at all, but with the economy still running, operating, and with still investments coming, society can run. And so I believe that Beijing is trying to run a Singaporean model, Hong Kong's, giving some degree of openness and some limited degree of freedoms in markets, but with total elimination of dissent and complete control politically and refusal to progress with political reform. And it might be the plan of the regimes, but still, I believe without the democracy, without checks and balances, dictatorship always makes mistakes. And at that time, and people will rise again.
Mm-hmm. And looking for comparisons in history, I guess there's an obvious one to me in a sense, which is what happened in 1989 with the activists and dissidents who left China to come to Australia and the US and Europe after the crackdown following the Tiananmen Square protests and massacre. And obviously one of the things that happened then was many of the dissidents lost their connection to their audiences back in China. They ended up spending more time, in some cases, fighting with each other rather than fighting with the communist parties. How, from a kind of position in exile, how do you sustain the movement?
Yeah, that's a question I'm looking deep into, because I want that to be our lesson to our generations of exiled, because we want to continue to fight on. We don't want to lose our influence, our power. We want to make the call so Hong Kongers can gather together and be a stronger power. But then we understand that it can be difficult as time goes by and as we might not be able to make really concrete changes. But I think we are different from the 1989 generation of exiles in that it's easier for us to communicate among each other and with back to the people in Hong Kong with technologies. So I'm very keen on keeping connections and communications with what's happening in Hong Kong and my fellow friends in Hong Kong, so that we want them to know that we are not distant from them. We are still one of them. We still feel the pain, and I share my pain with them every day. And with that communication, that gives me strive and motivation to go on. And it's easier for my generation as well to survive economically. And with it's easier to get financial support from Hong Kong. So with technology, it's easier for us to be more transparent financially so that they know we are still under some kind of accountability. So I'm more confident that we will learn a lesson and turn a brighter page for Hong Kong as an exile.
But I guess I know from talking to Nathan Law that one of the problems of this situation is that because of the national security law and the fact that you're now overseas, actually by you even just talking to your family members or friends, let alone engaging in political activity with fellow Hong Kongers back home, you could in a way be kind of endangering them because they could be accused of colluding with you're now a foreign force, a hostile foreign force, I guess, being based here.
Yeah, but that's very true. And that can be risky. So we take precautions and with technology, but of course it can be 100% safe. But then there are different ways of doing it more securely. And I believe that it's the risk that we need to take, because now in overseas, in freedoms, we can say the things that we want to say. There are times we need to make calls for Hong Kongers to do something, to struggle, and of course in a safe way. But then without the opportunity to make those calls, and it would be hard for them to make the call themselves. It would be more dangerous for them to make the call locally. For example, in upcoming so-called elections in Hong Kong, the parliamentarian elections, and it's now completely controlled by Beijing. And now everyone who wish to be a candidate needs to get nomination from Beijing. So Beijing totally runs the show. But then what the option left for Hong Kong is to vote informal, to vote a blank vote. But the regime sees that, and now legislation has been passed that voting, asking people and advocating for a blank vote or informal can be itself a criminal act. So the Hong Kongers cannot make those calls, and it have to be us who make the call. So still, it's necessary for us to keep connections, to understand what Hong Kongers think, and then we can say what they want to say internationally in a safe place.
Yeah, I'm going to come to you all for questions in a sec, but I just have one more question for Ted, which is a difficult one, I'm afraid, to end up. It's obviously very unlikely that Xi Jinping is going to wake up tomorrow and realize that democracy is actually a great idea for Hong Kong after all. But what's your best case for how Hong Kongers might secure their democratic rights and their autonomy one day? How do you think, sort of looking out, I guess, to the next 10, 20 years, and maybe after that when Xi Jinping's maybe stepped down, how might this happen?
It's not too difficult for me, and I think it's more confirmed or assured to many Hong Kongers that we don't only wish to have Xi Jinping changed. We don't only hope for another more open-minded leader to run China. We want CCP to step down from power. And I personally believe that might be the only way to go for Hong Kongers. And I won't go as far as to talk about, for example, independence of Hong Kong. Might not be practical, pragmatic for Hong Kongers, at least now. But then going towards the goal of having the power dissolved, or at least I'm not satisfied going back to what we were, a half democracy. After all the brutal crackdowns, after all that we have lost, we want a genuine one, genuine democracies. And of course, I don't believe that CCP would give us that. So it will take a lot of struggle, a lot of fight, a lot of confrontations until it steps down from power. And that would be the best end game.
Okay, well, we have about 15 or 20 minutes for questions. So if you just stick your hands up and Andrew will come to you with a mic. And if you could just tell us your name and affiliation, if you have one. I think we've got one over here.
Hi, my name's Emma Rossi. I'm a former journalist and am a friend of Human Rights Watch. My question is what your recommendation would be for those of us that have friends and loved ones who might be working in Hong Kong for as an expat, and whether they should be doing something, and what that should be.
Yes, that's a very useful question, actually. There, Hong Kong is still an international city, even we've lost almost all of our freedom, but there are quite many expats still working in Hong Kong, Australians and other nationals. And they are mostly professionals. And I believe that it's useful to speak up in their professional bodies and to monitor and to speak up for the best practices and guidelines for their professions. Because now the CCP, the Hong Kong regime, is attacking every profession than to take away their rights. For example, the journalists and also the bankers and also all the licensing bodies, professional licensing bodies, taking away their rights. So it's their job to defend the right professionally and to be adhered to and uphold professional guidelines. I think that itself is useful against the erosion of power and avoid giving more and more power, and so that professions will be allied or be manipulating tools for the CCP. And also, it's relatively safer for other nationals who are in Hong Kong from political persecutions. Of course, there's a risk that they would just catch everyone and randomly and as hostages, but still, it's safer for expats, for Australians in Hong Kong, to speak up, at least on social media, and to be in or join civil societies in Hong Kong, support them. It's relatively safer, and if that can be done, that would be also best for Hong Kong's fight for freedom.
Thanks, Ted. My name's Warwick Jones, and I'm the Australian Federal Police Visiting Fellow here at the Lowy Institute. And over the years, I've worked with a number of Hong Kong police and trained with them as well. And they've always struck me as an organisation built on the British tradition of democratic policing. And my sense, knowing a number of them, is that there probably is quite a dilemma for them at the moment in terms of how they're doing their work. I'd be interested to see what your thoughts are on the legitimacy of the Hong Kong police force going forward.
Yes, thank you for the question. That's a very interesting one. It struck me as well. I couldn't believe our police, once prestigious internationally and respected by the people, has turned into something like, I would say, mobs and gangsters. It's almost there. And I believe one reason is that they are so used by the regimes, and they can be very brainwashed in their peer groups that they are really fighting against rioters for justice. It's really for the good for Hong Kong. They are so brainwashed. And on the other hand, they are, the word infiltrated by the CCP forces. So I understand that they are trained by somehow Liberation Army and the mainland Chinese police. So they have trainings together. So that changed their mindsets. And I don't know it's what's the best way to have them back, like when they were before. But then, for international collaborations, it's really for free countries and Western countries to have a clear cut with police, not to provide any weapons, not to provide any trainings, and be vocal to say that, under international standards, riot police shouldn't shoot people like that. It's not according to international safety protocols, and it's a clear abuse of human rights. So if police organizations in other countries in Australia can speak up, that would be very, very useful. And at least for those who really believe they are doing justice, to really strike them that they are not. Mm.
Ted, hi, thanks very much. I lived in Hong Kong for 15 years, so I was fascinated to come along and hear you talk. I think all of us knew who C.Y. Leung was. You know,
so pretty... just don't tell us your name and if you...
Ed Slade. I'm just a former Hong Kong resident. Most of us knew who C.Y. Leung was, you know, pretty nasty, fairly greedy guy, bad father, you know, all those things. Carrie was expected to be an improvement if we look back at when she was first elected. How do you think, who is Carrie Lam now? And how does she not walk the streets in shame at what she produced as a leader. I mean, disastrously bad tenure.
Yeah, that's also the other part that struck me, and I couldn't believe Carrie Lam would turn into like another person. And I still remember at the time, 2016, when I was first elected to the parliament, and we would have regular closed-door meetings with Carrie Lam. And she wasn't like that at that time. And we could have conversations. And I remember telling her that amongst the party members in the meeting rooms, I have the less confidence and trust in the government. So please behave and in the future and not to let Hong Kong's freedom deteriorate. And we can have conversation like that. But I believe that in the past few years, when the attitude of Beijing changed, Xi Jinping's attitude changed, she had to change the strategy. And she might not have full control anymore on Hong Kong. It's not her that's running Hong Kong. So it will be Beijing running it directly and she being a puppet. And of course, it's hard for me to understand why people's willing to be a puppet. I just can't comprehend. But that's what's happened. And now she's not Carrie Lam like she was anymore. And that's terrifying to see how people change because of political change. But I would say that the people won't change. The people like me will never change. We see what justice is and we'll fight on forever. But it's very sad to see how the other side of humanity.
We had a question here and then it'll come.
Thank you, Ted. My name's Prue Williams, and I'm a friend of Human Rights Watch. you say the end game, ultimately, for you and your movement is for the CCP to dissolve in what would be a new era, I suppose. What I'd like to know is your movement gaining any traction on the streets and ground in mainland China? I know that's probably hard to know, but do you have connections there? Do you feel that you're gaining any traction in mainland China?
That's a very valid point. That's the comment I get from time to time, that Hong Kong, even as an international city, but it's only 7 million people. But look at the population of China. So Xi Jinping's attitude and all the crackdown on Hong Kong its audience is not Hong Kong, it's the whole population of China. That's why it's confident and it's willing to give up Hong Kong's freedom. So it's important to be connected with the mainland Chinese to get them on board, but it's a very, very difficult task. And over the years, with so-called one country, two system, in the past, it kind of worked. In the sense that Hong Kongers and mainlanders have very different way of life, and the mainlanders have very limited access to information flow in Hong Kong. It can watch Hong Kong's news, but when it comes to politics, and then it suddenly would just pause on their TV. So they don't know what's happening in Hong Kong, and there's border still somehow, and from Hong Kong to mainland China. So Hong Kongers and mainlanders can be very separated in reality. So it's better when we are overseas, for example, in Australia, we can try to connect them and we find support and allies in many of their groups and they support Hong Kong. I'm grateful for that. But to influence the massive populations in Hong Kong, in mainland China, it's a very, very difficult task. We are looking up at ways using technologies, perhaps, to penetrate that. But it will take a very long time. And they are so, I would say, brainwashed with their educations that we should should not speak against the government, otherwise you're not good citizens and not loyal, not patriot. It's very hard to have breakthrough on that. It takes generations, but we'll try hard on that.
We have one right at the front.
Hi, thanks guys. My name is Michael Cox. I'm a Hong Kong permanent resident. I work for the South China Morning Post from 2011 to 2019. I now write a weekly column for the Apple Daily for now. I'm interested in the global reach of the national security law and the provision that that authorities claim they can charge anybody anywhere. It hasn't been enacted as yet, but I'm wondering what your thought... Obviously, you've probably thought about it, as have many of us. How do you think it will be used? And maybe you could share some of your experience on how your Danish friends have been affected.
Yes, the national security law has an extra territorial jurisdictions, and that's quite troubling for many, not only Hong Kongers, but also foreign nationals. But at least among the Hong Kong diaspora, and for many Hong Kongers overseas, you can see its effect in that, for example, back 2 years ago or last year, and there were rallies here in Australia and participated by a massive number of Hong Kongers. I believe the one in Sydney, we had more than 3,000 people together against the CCP regime in Hong Kong. But then after the national security law, and more people have to use face masks and hats and sunglasses and to hide their identities totally, because even those Hong Kongers in Australia, they have assets in and family members back in Hong Kong. They don't want them to be endangered. And as they go back to Hong Kong at the border, they can get very nervous. Would CCP know that I did protest against them? So I believe it's the fear that's been spreading using the national security law. And yes, it's affecting people's behavior. So people are nervous and cautious. And that's the effect. And for quite many foreign nationals, for example, if you have joined the Hong Kong protests here as Australians, and you're outspoken, you became a volunteer or an organizer of a rally in support of Hong Kong's freedoms. At the time, some point in the future, you travel to Hong Kong, and as you enter the border, you might get trouble entering, you could get expelled, and more than that, you can be detained. So it's possible with the national security law, because it harms the state power of the CCP. So that's the effect. But that's also something that we have to overcome. And I mean, be water. And you need to speak up, but then you need to be wise not to fall into the trap of CCP, and then it in turn losing everyone and having everyone in jail. And so also in that sense, I feel more responsible, because I can't go home anyway. My families are all here. I'll go very high profile. So to speak for those who are a bit nervous to speak. And so I feel I have a bigger role now. And those Hong Kong diaspora, those in exile, have bigger roles. And I wish those who have less connections with Hong Kong, that wouldn't, not like you have investments, you have family there, please speak up for Hong Kong, so because Hong Kong people need you.
I think we have time for one more question.
Hello, this is Paige from Transport Workers Union of Australia. And as we discussed that Hong Kong's press freedom is dying down, but I think Hong Kong still have a strong union movement. So my question is, Ted, do you think union movement is still a sustainable battleground for pan-democracy in Hong Kong to express their ideal, to expand their ideal of like democracy and freedom? Thank you.
Yes, I believe so. Thank you for the question. And now, politics is not a way to go because we can't participate in open and fair elections. The half democracy we used to have is gone. So I personally believe in the civil society, in people's power, and that's my experience of being a parliamentarian in the last 4 years, and all the freedom movements, what we call the anti-extradition movements, began because the Hong Kong regime introduced an extradition bill that Hong Kongers can be extradited back to mainland China for criminal trials. And I remember it's not us parliamentarians to block the bill from passing. It's the young protesters in the streets and risking their lives and their future for Hong Kong. So it's the people's power in the streets, in 1 million people's protest, 2 million people's protest, that really struck the world and showed the world our spirit. So it's all about civil society, and it's all about how we affect one person's mind and to spread the message, and in turn affecting people's view, changing people's view. And so union is a strong tool, and to get all the workers united. And of course, it's even more powerful at the times when we know that the regime is using economic duress in controlling the grassroots people. So the grassroots people need to be organized and to stay firm that striking balance between having the work right and having the right protected, but still at the same time knowing what and where justice is in society. And think about that, without freedom, without the genuine freedoms, and can we really speak of labor rights, right? And I think that's a prerequisite, that we need to have freedom first. That's why, of course, labor movements and unions, we are totally in line with you, and it's important to get them organized.
I want to thank you all for coming today. Do keep an eye on our website for future events and research, and I'm sure Ted will stick around for a few minutes if you want to talk, but please join me first in giving him a round of applause for Ted's talk.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much.
Yeah.